This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Grost. Lyricist Jerry Lieber died Monday in Los Angeles. He was 78. He and his partner Mike Stoller wrote some of the most memorable rock and roll songs of the 50s and 60s.
Going to Kansas City, Kansas City, here I come. Going to Kansas City, Kansas City, here I come. They got some crazy little women there, and I'm gonna get me one.
Say the neon lights are bright on Broadway.
On Broadway.
They say there's always magic in the air.
I took my troubles down to Madame Ruth. You know that gypsy with the gold cap tooth. She's got a pad on 34th and Vine, selling little bottles of love potion number 9.
What I say? Whoa, 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 Ruby, Ruby, how I want you now, like a ghost, I'm gonna haunt you now. Ruby, 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 will you be mine sometime?
Everybody always picking on me.
When the night has come and the land is dark and the moon is the only light we'll see, no, I won't be afraid. Oh, I won't be afraid. Just as long as you stand by me. So darling, darling, stand by me. Oh, stand by me. Oh, stand by me, stand by me.
Lieber and Stoller wrote for Elvis Presley, the Coasters, the Drifters, and Benny King. They not only wrote songs, they often produced them. In fact, Lieber and Stoller were the first rock and roll producers to actually get credit on a record for their work. One of rock's greatest producers, Phil Spector, got his start as one of Lieber and Stoller's assistants. Lieber and Stoller met in L.A. when Lieber was still in high school, and they were soon writing songs professionally. Lieber was the lyrics half of the team, and he was known for sassy phrases that captured the vernacular spoken by young people of his day. Terry spoke to Lieber and Stoller in 1991. They began by listening to the original 1953 version of Hound Dog, sung by Big Mama Thornton.
You ain't nothing but a hound dog.
Jerry Lieber, Mike Stoller, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
The record we've been listening to, Big Mama Thornton's recording of Hound Dog, was your first major hit as songwriters and producers. What was it about her that led to this song?
Well, Mike and I were invited to Johnny Otis's rehearsal studio to listen to and look at some of his artists. Big Mama was one of them. And she was really formidable. She was scary looking. She was big. And she must have weighed about, oh, anywhere from 275 to 350. And she had this really gutty, guttural, growling sound in her voice. And the both of us fell in love with her. And we just loved what she looked like, and we loved what she sounded like. She sang Ball and Chain. And we decided to take off that minute and go to Mike's house and try to write something for her.
Well, how did you come up with this song, though?
Well, Mike was driving, and I was banging on the roof of the car, and I was trying to come up with something nasty that would be, at the same time, playable, that wouldn't be censored, you know? And the closest I could get to what I was thinking was, you ain't nothing but a hound dog.
So you were thinking four-letter word, epithet, and what
right.
you came up with hound dog.
Right, which sort of, you know, made it, it felt right, and it seemed like it would be passable.
Mike, let me ask you how you think Elvis handled the song differently from Big Mama Thornton.
How he handled it differently? Yeah. Well, he handled it very differently. He didn't sing it in the same tradition of blues intonation that Big Mama used. And also, the lyrics were considerably different because Big Mama's, the way the song was written for Big Mama is really about a gigolo. It's a woman complaining about a gigolo. And Elvis couldn't sing that song. So he sang a version of it, which I think, as I'm told, he heard from a lounge act in Las Vegas, that he heard singing the song in Vegas. Now, I had heard that he knew Big Mama's record and loved it, but it was only after he heard this lounge act do it that it seemed appropriate for a male singer.
You know, I think it was the first time Elvis sang Hound Dog on TV. It was on the Steve Allen Show, and he sang it to a little hound dog. It was very cute.
A basset hound.
A basset hound, okay. Did you feel really kind of cheated by that? Here's a song that you wrote that was supposed to be an epithet, you know, about a gigolo, and it ends up with someone as forceful as Elvis making it into, you know, this guy, cute little harmless song on the Steve Allen Show.
We thought it was kind of dopey.
Yeah.
I mean, I wasn't offended. I just thought it was silly, that's all.
Yeah. Now, you wrote several songs for Elvis, including Jailhouse Rock. Why don't we play a little bit of that?
One threw a party in the county jail. The prison band was there, they began to wail. The band was jumping and the joint began to swing. You should have heard this knocked out jailbird sing. Let it rock. Everybody let it rock. Everybody in old cell block.
Jailhouse Rock, written by my guests Jerry Lieber and Mike Stoller. Now, you wrote a lot of songs for Elvis's movies. This was really one of the best songs. Some of the movies had really awful songs in them. Did you have to write some of those awful songs?
Oh, yeah.
Sure.
Oh, we loved writing the awful songs because they were more fun. Things like Steadfast, Loyal, and True. you know, songs where he was supposedly graduating high school, but we had to write these terrible songs. The problem was this. You got a script, and there would be a moment in a scene where they would want a song. Now, we would tell the director, we would tell Hal Wallace, the producer, we'd say, look, you know, we're not trying to get out of writing a song, but this is really a dumb place for a song, you know? I mean, the guy's about to go into the boys' room and comb his hair, and I don't know why he has to sing, I'm going into the boys' room to comb my hair. And they'd say, we want the song. So we'd write it. So a lot of those songs that shouldn't have been written were written and recorded, and they're there for posterity.
A lot of the songs that you wrote over the years were novelty songs, songs like Charlie Brown, Love Potion Number 9, Yakety Yak, Poison Ivy. I think I just named all Coaster songs here. But how did you get so involved with novelty songs?
We didn't think of them as novelties.
We thought of dark dramas. We were both trying to imitate Tolstoy and Dickens, and I guess we just fell short of the mark.
Well, let me play one of your novelty songs, and this is Charlie Brown.
V-V-5-5-4-4-4. I smell smoke in the auditorium.
Everybody always picking on me. That's him on his
knees. I was wondering if one of the reasons why you wrote so many novelty songs is had to do with that you were two white Jews writing for a lot of R&B groups who were black. I don't know how self-conscious you were about that, but I was thinking, well, maybe it was easier in a way to write songs that were funny as opposed to maybe the presumptuousness of writing something that was really heartfelt when you were writing for other people. Though you wrote a lot of those songs, too.
Well, to begin with, these two white Jews really experienced themselves as black. I was brought up in an essentially predominantly black neighborhood in South Baltimore.
Mm-hmm.
And Stoller can speak for himself, but he went to interracial camps when he was a kid. No, it's not that. We really felt that we were very black, and we acted black, and we spoke black, and because you see, when I was a kid growing up, it was where I came from, it was hip to be black, you know. I mean, to be white was kind of square, you know, and the clothes, you know, you had to dress a certain way, and if you looked a certain way and you spoke a certain way, then you were okay, and if you didn't, then you were lame. And all, you know, teenagers especially are very, very conscious about what is hip and what is lame and what is square and what is out and what is in, you know? And, I mean, I grew up right there in the middle of a black culture, and I knew dead on what it was, you know? I mean, firsthand.
And I belonged to a social club in Harlem from the time I was 13 years old, and I used to go up there every weekend. And from there, of course, I used to hang out on 52nd Street and listen to all the jazz musicians in the little clubs. So that was a part of my life.
When I met Stoller, he was sporting a goatee and he was wearing a beret, and he would stand hunched over like he had a humpback, and he'd smoking, and he would say, "Mmm." You say anything to him. You say, "You want to go to the movies?" He'd say, "Mmm." Or you say, "You hungry, man? Let's go eat." He'd go, "Mmm." Because he was like that, right? It wasn't until he was about 21 that he started talking.
So let me ask you again if there was a point when you started thinking that it was presumptuous to think of yourselves as being black.
I think when Baraka turned to me one day, because Leroy Jones had been my buddy for years, and Leroy in New York told me that I was the greatest living black songwriter. This was when he was Leroy Jones. And about 2 or 3 years later, when the revolution started to happen, right, he informed me that I was white.
How did you respond?
I sort of felt like I'd been betrayed.
I think he was astonished to find out.
I started sitting in the front of the bus.
One of the things that you are famous for having pioneered was bringing a string section to rock and roll, or to rhythm and
blues.
That
was Mike's fault.
Yeah, let me ask you, you know, on the Drifters recording of There Goes My Baby, that's the classic example of you bringing strings on. What went through your mind to do it?
I can tell you exactly what was on my mind. Just the line, the melodic line. And I was playing it. I used to joke about this one because it sounded like Borodin and I sounded like one of the Caucasian melodies. And
I don't know if you get the pun, but he's been saying this for many years and I always thought it was funny.
Right.
The fact that he would use a Caucasian melody on this.
Jerry heard it and he said, "That sounds like strings." And I said, "Why not?" And so, why not? We We had five violins and one cello. And they were all basically playing in unison.
Because Jerry Wexler wouldn't spring for six violins and two celli.
Now, another thing that happened on this record was you introduced a Latin rhythm that you used.
The Bayonne rhythm was one that both Jerry and I adored. It was I first heard it in the film Anna with Silvana Mangano. And they had a small Brazilian group, and the record Anna became a fairly big hit, and it was a popular melody. And I just loved the rhythm on it, and we had always looked for a place to use it. We'd used it maybe once before on a early record that was not particularly successful. And we had the opportunity to use it on this record date, and there happened to be a timpani left over from another recording session in the studio, and we used it. Now, the drummer was not a percussionist. He was just a trap drummer, and he didn't know how to use the tuning pedal on the timp, so he played one note throughout the entire thing, which gave it a rather bizarre, muddy bottom with all kinds of weird overtones. And it was kind of fascinating, though. And that's where we first had a successful use of that Bayonne rhythm, which, in case anybody's wondering, is boom, 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 boom.
Which finally was used, I think, and is responsible for maybe over 1,000 hits, because this Brazilian rhythm supports a slow ballad without the ballad seeming to be slow or sluggish. It keeps it moving, and everyone from Burt Bacharach to Phil Spector to you name it have leaned heavily on the support of this rhythm pattern.
My guests are the songwriting and production team of Jerry Lieber and Mike Stoller. What is your style of working together? Let me go back to when you were writing hits nearly every day. What was your style of working together? Would you be in the same room?
We'd be in the same bathrobes. We were matching bathrobes. Yeah, we'd be in the same room. Actually, Stoller would normally sit at the piano. And I would sort of stalk around the room and smoke. Now, neither of us smoke anymore, so it's taken half the fun out of work. But he would sit at the piano and fiddle. And finally, I don't mean fiddle. I mean fiddle with a piano, you fool.
And Lieber would stalk around the room screaming.
Right.
And if something stuck to the wall, something he screamed, we work on it.
We take a biopsy and work. But now that was the early days. The way we work these days, when we work, I usually have a fix on a lyric, and I'll bring in 8 or 10 or 12 lines, and I'll give it to Mike, and he'll go home and work on it, because this way we can have some time alone.
And it's is a delight. Or I will write a melody or half a melody and lay it on Jerry and say, listen, what can you do with this? And then we'll get back together and tear it apart and start over.
I want to thank you both very much for talking with us.
Thanks.
Righto, yeah, it was fun.
Songwriters Jerry Lieber and Mike Stoller speaking with Terry Gross in 1991. Lieber died Monday at the age of 78. Here's On Broadway, a record which Lieber and Stoller produced and co-wrote with Barry Mann and Cynthia Weil. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
They say the neon lights are bright on Broadway.
On Broadway.
They say there's always magic in the air.
On Broadway.
But when you're walking down that street and you ain't had enough to eat, the glitter of
this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Our next guest is writer and director Greg Mottola. He directed the hit teen comedy Superbad, and he wrote and directed two critically acclaimed films, Day Trippers, released in 1996, and the 2009 film Adventureland, set in an amusement park in the 1980s and starring Jesse Eisenberg. Mottola also directed several episodes of the TV series Arrested Development, Undeclared, and The Comeback. Mottola's latest film, Paul, is now out on DVD. It's written by and stars Simon Pegg and Nick Frost, the English duo best known for the comedy Shaun of the Dead and Hot Fuzz. In Paul, they play a pair of English science fiction buffs who are touring UFO sites in the American West when they encounter a real alien named Paul, who ends up traveling with them in their rented RV. The creature is a computer-generated graphic, but has the voice and attitude of Seth Rogen. In this scene, Peg's character is driving the RV, and the alien Paul is up front eating pistachios. Frost's character, who passed out upon meeting Paul, wakes up in the middle of the scene and attacks the alien.
I love pistachios. I hate when you get a closed one, right?
I usually just bite them.
No. You don't do that at all. You tap them. If they don't open on their own, you throw them away.
No, that's muscles.
No, it's pistachios.
What are you?
Graham, got the castle.
And this is Stumps. He's okay. He's friendly. His name's Paul.
Alien's Uncle Paul.
Was that Klingon? You psychotic nerd.
Listen, Paul is from a small M-class planet in the northern spiral arm of the Andromeda Galaxy.
Thank you.
He looks too obvious.
There's a reason for that, Clive. Over the last 60 years, the human race has been drip-fed images of my face on lunchboxes and T-shirts. In case our species do meet, you don't have a spaz attack.
I did not have a spaz attack!
Don't do it again!
Well, Greg Mottola, welcome to Fresh Air. This film is a weird road trip with an alien. And it doesn't work if the alien doesn't work visually and isn't funny. Talk a little bit about creating Paul, the alien, his look, his personality.
Well, that was one of the reasons I wanted to make the film, because I liked the challenge of making a CGI character that gave a kind of naturalistic comedy performance. We've seen CGI characters do a lot of things, but not so much that. You might say that in a all-CG film, but not so much in a mixed live-action CG character who's photoreal and has to have a kind of, you know, consistent, believable psychology. In the beginning, when we decided we wanted Seth to do this, one of the caveats was that Seth would not be available for the actual filming. He was going to go make The Green Hornet. So we knew we wouldn't have him on set. Hence, the lead actors, Simon Pegg, Nick Frost, and Kristen Wiig would be acting to a stick with ping pong balls for eyes and a script supervisor reading lines. And I thought, well, that's problematic.
Yeah, I was wondering, that's one of the first things I wondered, because in the film, I mean, the alien, it totally works. You totally believe he's in the RV with them and everywhere. And I'm sitting there thinking, how do you act if this is blank space?
You know, I went back and looked at E.T. Obviously, I studied a lot of Spielberg films and other sci-fi films from the period because they're referenced throughout the movie. So I was watching E.T. and I was thinking, well, you know, a big part of what sells this are the performances of those kids. You know, Drew Barrymore really makes you think she's meeting an alien for the first time. The creature design is amazing in E.T., but, you know, I knew that the actors had to sell it. So I turned to one of the co-stars in the film, Joe Latrulio, who plays O'Reilly. He and Bill Hader are paired up as these two ridiculous, comical federal agents who are in pursuit of Paul. And I asked him if he'd be the voice of Paul during the filming, and he said yes, thank God, and he was he took it very seriously. He would study tapes of Seth Rogen rehearsing the character so he could see what Seth was doing with it. And then he'd bring his own improvisations to the actual filming, which I think just made an enormous difference for Simon and Nick and Kristen, and to have someone they could play against, someone they could improvise with. And then later in post-production, Seth recreated some of Joe's ideas and lines and improvs, and, you know, it was this very strange theater troupe's, you know, vibe where people are trading the character back and forth. It's like, you know, sometimes there'll be a play where two different actors play the same part on different nights of the week.
Yeah, I'm picturing you doing this job of directing, and, you know, and directing is, it's an artistic endeavor, but it's also this huge management thing because you have production schedules and big crews and budgets and all that. And so you've got this, you know, you've got these pre-recorded lines of Seth Rogen. You're trying to simulate what this computer-generated guy is going to look like on the set. Manage all the other actors, not to mention the fact that this movie also includes bar fights, explosions, car crashes. Gosh. That's a lot to manage, isn't it?
Well, and it was done on a budget. There are comedies where people are just sitting around in restaurants talking that have bigger budgets than this film. You know, there were places where the limitations were frustrating, for sure. For instance, we had action scenes, car chases and explosions. We had no second unit, which, you know, for the listener, most action films tend to have a second unit where a stunt coordinator is off simultaneously shooting the action bits, so the main production can be focusing on acting and so forth. We just had to kind of work it into our schedule, cram it in somehow. And I guess the fun part about that is I got to ride around in the little car that goes super fast that has a camera strapped to it, although I feared for my life a few times. You know, it's I started out in indie films. This is quite different than shooting a 16mm film in 15 days like I did way back in the mid-90s on my first film, The Day Trippers. And I also, you know, my heroes are people like Woody Allen. I kind of thought I would only work exclusively in the world of, you know, naturalistic comedy drama. But there is the side of me that also loves Hollywood, and I wanted to see what that felt like. I wanted to see what it felt like to do special effects. And I don't think I'm going to dive right into a special effects movie next. My agents have asked me that. I said, I think I need two people sitting in a restaurant talking. But I certainly learned a lot.
You've done a lot of sort of character-driven stuff. I mean, your earlier film, Day Trippers, was, you know, it was this relationships among family members. And here you've got this sophisticated computer-generated alien. Kind of interesting that you're directing that kind of film.
Well, when I read a script, I always, the first question I ask myself is there something that I could bring to it that maybe the next guy wouldn't? Because I've read a lot of very good scripts and thought there are people who could do this better than I. What I liked about this challenge was that, in my mind, Paul should give a naturalistic comedy performance. So I felt that it needed to be played like a real actor would play it. He is a character in a road movie. He is Jack Nicholson in Five Easy Pieces. He just happens to be one of these people in a car. In fact, Simon said to me when I asked him point blank when we first met on this, are you sure I'm somebody you'd want to have do this? And he said, look, I saw your first film, Day Trippers, in London in the theater, and in a way, this could be like that in places. It could be people driving around in a car, and one of them just happens to be an alien.
An extraterrestrial.
Yeah, it just happens to be. You know, we've all had that experience.
You had a big success with Superbad, the film with Jonah Hill, Michael Cera, and others. And I thought we'd listen to a clip here. I mean, this is, folks who saw the film will remember this. This is three high school seniors played by Jonah Hill, Michael Cera, and their buddy Fogel, who is played by Christopher Mintz-Plasse. And they want to get booze. And in this scene, Fogel, their nerdy friend, has gotten a fake ID just made. It happens to be a Hawaiian driver's license, and they're discussing whether it will work. Let's listen.
All right, that's good. It's hard to trace, I guess. Wait, you changed your name to McLovin? McLovin? What kind of a stupid name is that, Fogel? What, are you trying to be an Irish R&B singer?
Oh, they let you pick any name you want when you get down there.
And you landed on McLovin.
Yeah, I was between that and Muhammad.
Why don't you just pick a common name like a normal person?
Muhammad is the most commonly used name on Earth.
Fogel, have you ever actually met anyone named Muhammad?
Have you actually ever met anyone named McLovin?
No, that's why you picked a dumb name. Give me that. All right. You look like a future pedophile in this picture, number one. Number two, it doesn't even have a first name. It just says McLovin.
What? One name? One name? Who are you, Seal?
Fogel, this ID says you're 25 years old. Why wouldn't you just put 21, man?
Seth, listen up. Face. Every day, hundreds of kids go into the liquor store with their fake IDs, and every single one says they're 21. How many 21-year-olds do you think there are in this town?
Let's stay calm, okay? Let's not lose our heads. No. It's a fine ID. It's gonna work. It's passable, okay? This isn't terrible. I mean, it's up to you, Fogel. This guy's either gonna think, here's another kid with a fake ID, or here's McLovin, the 25-year-old Hawaiian organ donor. Okay? So what's it gonna be?
I am McLovin.
And that's from the film Superbad, directed by our guest, Greg Mottola.
There weren't that many bleeps. I was wondering how many.
Yeah, how are we going to do that on the radio, right? Right. These characters are you know, decent adolescent guys, but they are completely obsessed with getting some sexual experience and getting alcohol as a route to getting sexual experience. How much like these guys were you when you were in high school?
I'm gauging the likelihood of my parents listening to this. When I read the script, I thought I completely relate to them. They are entirely inept. They don't know anything about women. It's rather sad. And I thought that's, you know, if we can make this feel real and psychologically accurate, maybe this movie will have some life to it. Yeah, I was a bit like those guys. I was an art student. I was kind of like – I became – the forger of IDs because I was had the best art skill. So I was like Donald Pleasance in The Great Escape. I was always making fake IDs for people, which is, and I'm sort of embarrassed to admit that. But
I think the statute of limitations has expired. This was the 80s you were making fake IDs?
Yeah. So yes, I had some of my moments like that.
Well, I want to talk about Day Trippers, which is, I think, a terrific film. And it was worth preparing for this interview just to be able to watch it again. And let me just kind of mention the plot, and we'll listen to a clip. It's about a family that lives in the suburb. There are two grown daughters, one played by Hope Davis, at home has found a romantic note on the floor, which might have been meant for her husband, Lewis, who works in New York City. This is a suburb of New York. And Lewis works in New York in the publishing world. He's already headed off for work, and she sits down with members of her family. They say, oh, my gosh, what does this note mean? Is he having an affair? And they all decide to pile into the family station wagon for a trip into New York to ask Lewis about it. And there begins a remarkable road trip movie. And what we're going to hear here is some conversation along the road to New York. One of the sisters, played by Parker Posey, has her boyfriend along. He's sort of a pseudo-intellectual named Carl, and he gets into a conversation about his work that also brings in Annie Mira, who plays the mom of the family. Let's listen. Begins with Parker Posey.
Carl, tell Mom and Dad about your novel. Carl wrote a novel, everyone. It's great. It's just far out. It's brilliant.
I don't think your parents want to hear my novel.
Mom and Dad, do you want to hear about Carl's novel?
Oh, yeah, sure, Carl.
Well, Rita, it's an allegory about spiritual survival in the contemporary world. The main character is this freak of nature. He's this man who doesn't have a normal head. He was born with a dog's head.
A dog's head?
Yeah, you know, sort of a fantastical story.
It's like a fable.
Yeah, like Master and Margarita or...
Animal Farm.
Animal, yeah, exactly. Very Kafka-esque.
Carl, I'm not an educated woman.
It's Dr. Seuss for adults, Mom.
Oh. Oh, yeah.
So, everyone else in the book is normal, except for the man with the dog's head, who really only wants...
What kind of dog?
Dad, it's not important.
No. It is important. Actually, that's very important. It's a German short-haired pointer. You see, it's actually especially... important that it's a pointer, because that's a crucial metaphor, because in the book he's sort of a visionary, you know, pointing the way to salvation.
Joe loves dogs. Remember Peppa? We had to put her to sleep.
Mother.
And that is from Day Trippers, written and directed by our guest Greg Mottola. Fun to hear that again, isn't it?
I have not watched the film in over a decade, so it's yeah, a lot comes back.
Right. You know, as I read about this, it's amazing that you got, I mean, this is an impressive cast. You know, Liev Schreiber, Parker Posey, Stanley Tucci, Hope Davis, Anne Meara, Campbell Scott, and Marcia Gay Harden. And from what I read, it sounds like you paid them like tortilla chips and Subway tokens. I mean, how did you get – I mean, these people were better known later than they are – now than they are then. But how did you get a cast like that with such a minuscule budget?
Well, one of the advantages of being in New York City and trying to get a career off the ground is that you're in a city filled with some very creative, talented people. And I got to meet some of them socially. I became friends with Campbell Scott, and he introduced me to Hope Davis. Another friend of mine from school had worked on the movie Dazed and Confused and knew Parker Posey, and Parker introduced me to Liev. And I just did a lot of begging. You know, the truth is good actors are always looking to do something different. They are dying to play slightly odder characters or work on movies that aren't straight down the middle. So I took advantage of that, and you know, we designed the film in a way that if it ever got sold, we'd pay everyone back. So the upfront costs were incredibly low. We shot the whole thing for about $60,000, and you know, in a weird way, because no one was telling me what to do. Of course, it's an experience I want to recreate again, because it's a little trickier when you're, you know, someone else is footing the bill and millions of dollars are at stake.
Yeah. What were some of the obstacles that you faced in shooting this thing in, what, like 16, 17 days?
There are scenes in the film where there's just one single take on every person, where we didn't even get to do a take two because we had, you know, 12 pages of dialogue to do in one day. The first day of shooting, our camera had been stolen. We were unloading the truck and we had no camera. So by the time we scrambled and found one, we had 2 hours left. So, you know, I shot everything I needed from that location because it was a location we couldn't come back to in 2 hours. It was, you know, not ideal, but in a way it taught me something about resourcefulness.
Right. And the scene that we heard was inside a car. And it occurred to me as I watched it that it seems the camera was actually inside the car as opposed to, you know, traveling next to it with on a mount or something.
Yeah, I mean, that was one of the things we had to resort to do it. I'm actually hiding in the back of the station wagon underneath a blanket with the sound man in all those scenes. Actually, in that particular scene, the sound was so bad because of the Long Island Expressway, we had to loop the entire scene. Everyone's voice had been replaced, which as a filmmaker, as I listened to it, I can tell. But I think we got away with it. That was very challenging. But, you know, it taught me some technical skills.
Yeah. You did a lot of directing in television for some really great shows. I mean, Undeclared and Arrested Development. You want to just tell us a little how you got into that and what that experience was like?
Well, when I came out of film school, I was hoping to emulate heroes of mine like Woody Allen and kind of write and direct my own small movies. And then I realized that that's actually quite hard to do. It's very hard to be Woody Allen. And I realized I just need to be working and I need to work with good people. And Judd Apatow called me, asked me if I wanted to direct an episode of his second television series, Undeclared. And I think before he finished the sentence, I yelled yes several times and essentially moved from Manhattan to Los Angeles immediately because I was dying to get experience. And it was one of the better decisions I've made in my life.
Is there an episode or a particular moment that you really treasure?
Well, working with Judd is kind of like comedy boot camp. He does have an amazing comedy mind. And you know, Judd was one of the first people who told me, you know, if a joke is funny but it's not moving the story forward, you have to cut it. You have to be disciplined. You have to, you know, or if a joke is counter to the character's psychology, you have to cut it. He has a real aesthetic about storytelling and trying to balance comedy and psychology and storytelling and plot and all those things. So I took a lot away from that. Judd also has a great kind of Mike Lee Cassavetes version of comedy where part of the reason he loves improv so much is that it puts the actors in a position where they don't know what the other actor is going to do. You can get lightning in a bottle with that technique because an actor is waiting for a line sometimes that's in the script and something else comes. And they have to be on their toes, and it elicits often a response that's quite surprising. And if the actor is really in the moment and very inventive, surprising, funny, wonderful things happen. And I really admire Judd's techniques in that regard. In TV, you know, the director is it's not an auteur medium for directors. It really is the producer-writer's medium. As such, it takes a lot of the heat off of you, so you get to try things that are harder to try in features because there's so much pressure and so much money at stake. It was quite freeing to do television for a few years.
Well, Greg Mottola, it's been fun. Thanks so much.
Oh, thank you so much, Dave.
Greg Mottola directed the films Day Trippers, Superbad, and Adventureland. His latest film, Paul, is now out on DVD. In 1980, Fidel Castro allowed 125,000 disaffected Cubans to take boats to the United States. Known as the Mariel Boat Lift, the exodus included up to 25,000 criminals. In his 1983 movie Scarface, director Brian De Palma tells the fictional story of one of them, Tony Montana, played by Al Pacino. In the years since its release, this gangster film's popularity has grown and grown. Now Universal has brought out a new Blu-ray edition. Our critic at large, John Power, says the occasion has him thinking about why the movie has a bigger reputation today than it did when it first came out.
Back in school, I was always amused to hear about classics that were dismissed when they first came out. You know, how Moby Dick wrecked Herman Melville's literary career, or how The Wizard of Oz was considered a disappointment when it was first released. I naturally assumed that had I been around back then, I wouldn't have missed the boat like that. But that was before I became a critic and discovered that over the years, you wind up with a pocket full of unused tickets from all the boats you've missed. Take, for instance, Scarface, the 1983 gangster picture directed by Brian De Palma, written by Oliver Stone, and starring Al Pacino, who gives a performance the size of a Caribbean cruise ship. When it first came out, I panned it for taking Howard Hawks' great 1932 movie and remaking it as something trashy, shallow, and excessive to the point of camp. I wasn't alone. The movie received lots of bad reviews, and even the public wasn't wild about it. It was only the 16th biggest box office draw of 1983, behind such cinematic triumphs as Mr. Mom and Jaws 3D. But Scarface didn't vanish like they did. Instead, over the next quarter century, it became a phenomenon. The movie's now so iconic that it doesn't even seem silly that Universal should bring out a fancy, metal-encased Blu-ray version, the Scarface Limited Edition Steelbook, which captures the story in all its lurid glory. By now, most everyone knows the plot. Pacino stars as Tony Montana, a small-time Cuban exile. Tony arrives in Miami along with his friend Manny Ribera, that's Stephen Bauer, and sets about trying to grab the American dream the only way he knows how, through crime. Over the course of nearly 3 hours, Tony rises from being a dishwasher to a drug lord, complete with a gold-bedecked mansion, a gorgeous mall, played with sly bitterness by Michelle Pfeiffer, and personal stashes of cocaine the size of the Matterhorn. Here, Tony, coked to the gills in a fancy restaurant, begins wildly braying at the well-heeled patrons he thinks are looking down on him.
You need people like me. You need people like me so you can point your fingers and say, that's the bad guy. So, what I make you? Good? You're not good. You just know how to hide. How to lie. Me, I don't have that problem. Me, I always tell the truth. Even when I lie. So say goodnight to the bad guy. Come on. The last time you're going to see a bad guy like this again, let me tell you.
I tell the truth, too. And here's an abiding one. If there's any quality that makes a piece of pop culture last, it's energy. And like the chainsaw that dismembers Tony's friend early on, Scarface just roars. It's as indelible as a cartoon, from Pacino's dementedly hammy acting to the bevy of quotable lines, almost none of which are clean enough to be quoted here. Yet the historical reason Scarface became a touchstone is that De Palma and Stone, especially Stone, the most plugged-in Hollywood filmmaker of the 80s, were actually ahead of their time. In Tony Montana's gaudy rise and fall, they predicted much of what we've seen in the last quarter century: the delirious consumerism, the reality TV egomania, the sense of getting ahead as a life-or-death struggle. Most strikingly, Scarface anticipates the rise of hip-hop culture, with its celebration of the gangsta life in all its aspiration and tragic sense of doom. Where a comfortable middle-class white guy like me found Tony's story a preposterous fantasy, rappers like Snoop Dogg and Flavor Flav saw it as a mythic version of something real. It captured their sense of what it was like to be an outsider trying to fight your way to the top, grabbing all the women and bling you could, because you know it could all quickly come to a violent end. They identified with Tony's braggadocio, his desire to live large, and his willingness to fight to the end. As with so much of hip-hop, this taste for Scarface entered the mainstream. These days, teens of all races quote Tony's lines and play the Scarface video game. For them, it's a classic. As for me, watching Scarface again the other night, I still found it comically over the top. But with the benefit of hindsight, I also saw that such an aesthetic judgment is only part of the story. You see, when it comes to pop culture, what finally matters is not whether something is good, but whether it has the power to burn its way into the national psyche. And Scarface undeniably has that power. I never would have believed it, but in 2011, millions of Americans find Tony Montana a figure who's truer and more resonant than Captain Ahab or even the Wizard of Oz.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue and Vogue.com. You can join us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at NPR Fresh Air. And you can download podcasts of our show at freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Melody Kramer is our associate producer of online media. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.